Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow, line dance song.
Hey, Sign Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. QT and Sign Guy with you as normal. Real fast before we dive into things, if you're looking for some wrestling in the next couple days, tonight, WTF in Carmel, Indiana. WCWO in Indianapolis like normal. ICS in Dunbar, West Virginia. And Still Domain Wrestling in Bloomington, Minnesota. Tomorrow night, you can find myself at Woo America in Bremerton, Washington. Galley Lucha is in Chicago, Illinois. BCW in Berwyn, Illinois. And Battle on the Border 2 in Harrison, Ohio tomorrow night. And without further ado, I would like to welcome everyone here. We are paying tribute to the late, great Buddy Wayne of Memphis Wrestling. Where the people unfamiliar, Buddy Wayne wrestled for many, many years around the Memphis territory. He is the father of Nightmare Ken Wayne, who a lot of fans will remember from the tag team The Nightmares. He was involved in a very famous feud with the Gilbert family, and Buddy Wayne and Tommy Gilbert helped launch the careers of their sons, Ken Wayne and Eddie Gilbert, during that feud. But he also went on to promote wrestling for a very, very long time in that Memphis region. He was one of the local promoters for the promotion. Very, very important figure. He was in the ring from the late 50s, early 60s, up until the late 80s. He was in the ring with people like the Gilberts, like Hulk Hogan, the Ultimate Warrior, Sting. He was in there with a lot of legendary people. Even guys like Ricky Morton, when they were young, got their start wrestling the likes of Buddy Wayne. And we are joined by a couple of people that knew him. One of the people from the 615, I believe we have Scott Till. Are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing?
Doing very well. And we are also joined today by someone that knew Buddy very well, Randy Hales, who also played a part in the promotion there in Memphis. Randy, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. I want to tell Scott, as just about 20 minutes ago, I do what I do a lot. That's research Nashville wrestling, and Scott's book on the history of Nashville wrestling is absolutely fantastic. But I am glad to talk about Buddy Wayne here today.
Awesome. Good to hear you.
Well, to start out with, Randy Hales, could you tell us about when you first met Buddy Wayne and what your relationship was like with Buddy?
I first met Buddy back in the 70s, and I was a fan that actually had the opportunity to sell merchandise and pictures, and Buddy would wrestle, not every week, but some on the cards in Jonesboro, Arkansas. I met him there later on. Obviously, as I became in the office, he was a spot show promoter, so I coordinated dates with him. And then, of course, in Power Pro Wrestling, especially during the beginning, Buddy was a great right hand as we worked together every day.
Now, Scott, you also knew Buddy going back to the old Memphis Wrestling in the Gulas era, I believe. Can you tell us how you first met Buddy and what your relationship was like with him?
Yes, I met Buddy sometime after I went to work for Nick, which was 1975, and he would come in just every once in a while to wrestle for Nick. Pretty much he was wrestling. He was also promoting Jonesboro and some other spot shows, but he would come in every once in a while, and he was always really nice to me. I was just a young punk college kid, and but he treated me really well, and I always liked Buddy. Later years, I probably got to know him better later years. We had a reunion here at our house for quite a few years, and he would come up to it, and I had a lot of time to sit down and just talk with Buddy about his career. And back in 97, I guess 98 or so, I did a interview with Buddy for my old Whatever Happened To magazine, and it I was fascinated by the things he had to tell me. I had no idea that Buddy was actually as instrumental as he was at promoting the small spot shows. I thought he was just, you know, just went and carried the money back like Danny Dusick used to do on the western end of the territory. But he was an actual promoter a lot of those shows, and some of the times Nick Lewis and Roy Welch would give him the cards. They'd say, well, here's a good lineup you could use in Jonesboro, and Buddy would use it at times. At other times, he'd change it if he thought, you know, he could draw better with a different program. So he had a lot to do with the business on the western end of the territory, a lot more than I ever knew.
Now, Randy, Buddy Wayne had a great career in his own right, but in the late 70s, when he brought his son Ken into things, he was almost a little bit more interested in launching his son's career as a wrestler, it seemed like. I know he's very proud of his family and getting Ken into the business. Did you ever get the sense that Buddy was like really hoping to have the family involved in the business and kind of establish the Wayne family, kind of like how the Lawlers were established and the Jarretts and all the great families there in Memphis?
Well, obviously at that point in the late 70s, when Ken made his debut, just about the same time that Eddie Gilbert made his debut, you know, there was just one Jarrett in the wrestling business at that point, and that was Jerry. There was just one Lawler, and that was Jerry Lawler. So I don't think he had that incentive. I think more he was pushed by his family, by his kids, because Buddy, let me say this, was a great, great, great father, and then later on a grandfather, and his son Ken became a professional wrestler. His son Greg, who was a guest on my Facebook Live last night, we had great response to that. He was a wrestling referee. And then Aubrey Wayne, which was his youngest son, was the senior referee of Power Pro Wrestling and was the best referee, I think. I'll make somebody mad here, but if any former Power Pro referees are listening to this podcast, however, Aubrey was good too. So Buddy just did, I think he raised his kids, and he was very active, and they went with him with all the time, all the towns. And so I don't think he discouraged his kids from being in the wrestling business, but as far as putting them in a hammer lock to force them into it, I don't think that as well either. I think it's just a natural thing. They fell in love with the business, and Scott knows that this business can be a sickness and it can be addiction, and the kids got addicted to the business, and that's what happened. And he was proud of not only Ken but all his sons. And his daughters, you know, are absolutely proud.
It's funny, oh, Randy, you sure say that, because I still, in all these years, I've still got that wrestling virus. I can't get rid of it. Can't seem to shake it.
That's why I do about 30 hours of programming about something I hadn't made a full-time living at since 2001, but it's my passion and my love and my addiction, for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, Scott, being from the Memphis territory, obviously you know how Buddy was very instrumental in a lot of the success there in the Memphis territory, be it running the spot shows or helping out just with his knowledge and, of course, being in ring. Do you think Buddy might be underappreciated by the fans of today as far as how instrumental he really was in Memphis wrestling, both the Gulas era and then later on in the Jarrett era?
Oh, absolutely. all I knew about when I came to Nashville, I really hadn't followed Nashville much. I saw a newspaper clip, you know, I used to go to a newsstand in Florida, in Bradenton, Florida, where I lived, and they carried a lot of old out-of-town newspapers, you know, Houston, Washington, D.C., Charlotte, North Carolina, Toronto. And I'd go sit in that drugstore, and I'd look through all those old newspapers and find out, see the clippings from all over the country. And they had the Nashville, Tennessee in there, and I used to see Buddy Wayne's name in it all the time. But all I ever saw was the fact that Buddy Wayne wrestled so-and-so either in the first, second, or third match most of the time. Well, yeah, always in Nashville, Memphis. And invariably, he generally lost. So all I knew about Buddy Wayne was, well, he was an opening card jobber, which I didn't know the term at that time, though. But I knew he was an opening card guy, just a guy that, you know, enhanced the card on the bottom. But what I didn't realize until years later, I told Buddy that. I said, I didn't know anything about you, but until I got talking with other people and then actually doing a really in-depth interview with Buddy, I never realized how much he had to do with the business in that western end of the territory. You know, he promoted Jonesboro, quite a few other towns, a lot of little spot shows. One show he told me about was well, he was telling me a story about Nick Gulas and Roy Welch, and some guy came in. He says, I just need to make better money because they're, you know, can you book me in better places? And Nick says, well, let me call my partner in. And so he called Roy in, and he tells the wrestler, tell Roy what you told me. And the kid says, well, he says, I'm just not making enough to make a living. And Roy says, well, we'll see that you get some better bookings. And no sooner had that kid walked out and the door shut behind him, Roy turned to Nick and he says, starve that SOB out. And that was the way it went, especially according to Buddy. Buddy has told me stories about that all the time, that everybody thinks Nick Gulas was the bad guy, but in many cases it was Roy Welch behind the scenes who was doing the dirty work. It's just Nick took the heat. It was sort of a good cop, bad cop type of thing. So, but I thought that was funny. But anyway, one of the towns Buddy told me, he says, Roy turned to Nick. He says, what are we running Monday night? He says, we're running Birmingham and Memphis. And Roy says, what else? He says, well, we're running Itabena somewhere, Mississippi or
Mississippi.
You know where that? Yeah, Mississippi. And I laughed. I thought that was the funniest thing. I said, Itabena. He said, that was a real town. I had no idea. But here he was promoting some small little – that was a town that Buddy ran at that time. He was running Itabena, Mississippi, a town you'd never heard of. And no doubt it drew well because the spot shows back then were just drawing unreal.
Scott, if I could ask a question, kind of listening to this whole show, and one thing I'm guilty of myself, and I get mad at myself doing it, and it was mentioned a little earlier, because obviously we said earlier we're talking Memphis wrestling, and the territory, especially back in the Gulas days, and obviously you were so hands-on living in Nashville on the towns on that end. Does it aggravate you when people just refer to it as Memphis wrestling?
No, I don't ever think of it that way. I don't know that I've ever even considered that. It just is what it is. They call it that way mainly because Memphis was such a big deal from 74 on, you know, 73 on. And I don't think it was referred to as the Memphis territory before that. I think in the early, you know, well, the 60s and the early 70s, most people referred to it as the Nashville territory. But then
Argulis.
Yeah, or Gulas or Gulas Welch territory, absolutely. But no, you know, it's funny, Randy. I never considered that. It just never crossed my mind. It doesn't bother me, you know, in any way at all. To me, it's all the same part and parcel.
One of the things I'd like to add about Buddy Wayne is he did have he promoted spot shows. That was his job. He would go because he lived in Memphis, and he lived in Memphis so he could go to the Coliseum and the TV. But very rarely, unless he was booked to wrestle, did I see him. Now, this is in the Jarrett era when we were in Louisville and Evansville and Lexington, Kentucky, and then later on in the early 80s when we did Nashville. But Buddy, it's not like we saw Buddy every single Saturday. Buddy had a great run, Scott, and you might have gone to these reunions, the Gulf Coast reunion down there they used to do in Mobile. Buddy Wayne drew a lot of money down there, and he teamed with, I believe I'm right, and Bob Ramstad was his tag team partner, and they're the world tag team champions. So Buddy had a big, huge, successful in-ring career, and he was pushed more as a top-level guy in Gulf Coast than he was in Memphis because his duties were split in Memphis. There, I'm guilty. I'm saying Memphis, but it is what it is. But do you know much of that, Scott, that Buddy was involved in Gulf Coast and went to those reunions?
Well, you just made me mad calling it the Memphis territory. No, I'm kidding. No, yeah, it wasn't Mobile, though. Buddy never really was a big deal in Mobile. It was in the Montgomery territory. When Bill Golden used him really well, and I don't know if the deal with him and Buck Ramstad was after Bill Golden sold it to Dennis Hall or before, but I do know that, yeah, he was a big name in Montgomery, Alabama, in that area down there, and it was for either, like I said, Bill Golden, Jimmy Golden's dad, or Dennis Hall, because Dennis Hall ended up taking the territory. Bill Golden said at one point the territory was really dropping, I guess, and he says, I ain't going to lose all my money promoting wrestling. He said, I'm going to get out before I do, and he ended up selling it to Dennis Hall. I don't know what the figures were. I wish I had talked to Dennis about that more, but I didn't. But anyway, when Dennis took over, he used Buddy on top a lot, and they did really well. The territory came up, and I don't know what happened to it. I don't think Dennis promoted very long, and I don't know why he quit promoting, but it wasn't too long after that the territory just pretty much folded up.
And another comment, guys, that I have on Buddy Wayne is that certainly there was a match that he wrestled. The last match that I know of that he wrestled, we did a little deal on TV when we had the very first developmental center for the WWF with Power Pro Wrestling. And we had this guy, and he really didn't go to another level, but he was a great, great talent. His name was Mick Tierney. And that was right, maybe even before UFC and mixed martial arts got going, but he had that kind of training, and we did a little deal where Mick had attacked Buddy's younger son, Aubrey, on television, and Buddy asked for a match, and we were running at the New Daisy Theater on Bill Street in Memphis, and Buddy was up there in age, but he pitched me the idea, and we did the match, and I was just depending on a Buddy just having the gut feeling that it would work, but I didn't have a good gut feeling, but I would take input. So we went with that idea, and the match got over. So Buddy's last match was it was probably 2000, and it was against Mick Tierney in Memphis, Tennessee at the New Daisy Theater.
Interesting. You know what?
Randy, you probably will know this. When he did that with his son, was that sort of a nod to the Angle years previously with the Gilbert family? That sounds like it was pretty similar to when they were breaking Ken and Eddie in and did the famous Angle where they handcuffed Tommy while they beat down Eddie.
It was kind of a separate thing. Basically, what we were looking for was getting Mick Tierney over as a psychomaniac, and Buddy really liked him because Buddy liked tough guys and people with legit background. Obviously, he wanted to do something with Aubrey, and there's egos, and Scott can tell you there's egos in this business, and I'm sure Buddy wanted to be involved in a feature program, a feature match there, and a rub to his son, Aubrey. But, you know, I really don't think at that point it was a takeoff on that angle that they did between the Gilberts and the Waynes.
Fair enough.
Funny, I missed all that. I was out of the business, and when I got out of the business in 1980, the only thing I watched was TBS, the Superstation show, and I watched that until about 1983, I guess, and I just quit watching it at that point. But I just really didn't follow much of anything. I did read the Wrestling Observer newsletter now and then. I got a great newsletter from a guy named Terry Justice where he had old newspaper clippings, sort of kept up with things through that. But for the most part, I missed all that, the Gilberts and the Waynes, and I didn't see any of it. Just never paid. I sort of lost interest.
Terry Justice, Scott, I'm sure you know this. He was the president of the Eddie Gilbert Fan Club. Do you know who the vice president was?
Well, I'd probably say Randy Hales.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love it. Eddie Gilbert. Isn't that great?
And Terry Justice, unfortunately, he passed away in a car wreck decades ago, probably now. But it was not if I remember, Scott, it wasn't an insider newsletter like Dave Meltzer or Wade Keller or Steve Beverly or so many people do, but it was a newsletter for the real wrestling fans that put results and did personality profiles and that sort of thing. And I miss those type of days. I really do.
I could not wait to go to the mailbox when I knew my TNT Times was going to be there. Every time I knew it was coming, man, I rushed out there to get it. And as you say, it wasn't an insider. He didn't give inside information. He didn't give any dirt on what was going on. No exposés. It was simply results, a ton of newspaper ads and clipping and articles. And I mean, it came out like weekly, sometimes twice a week. I can't imagine how much time Terry put into that. But what an incredible newsletter that was. And people today just don't have really a clue of what it was like back then for wrestling fans to get something like that. And you mentioned that it really wasn't, like a dirt sheet, like an expose newsletter. In some respects, it was, because back then, in 1972, I had a newsletter in Florida, and I called it the Tampa Scene. And I don't know how many I mailed out a month. I'd say probably close to 100 all over the United States. And I found a guy in Tampa, and it was strictly Tampa for a while. Then it became the whole territory. And all I did was print results and things that had happened on TV and results from all the towns in Florida. Well, I found a guy in Tampa owned a newsstand, and I asked him if he would carry them, and we made a deal on he'd give me a certain amount per book, and then he'd sell them, and he'd make the difference. Well, that got back to Eddie Graham, and apparently from what I was told, Eddie Graham was not happy. I wasn't exposing anything, but what it did do, and this is the same thing Terry Justice's bulletin did, when you look in there, you'd see that I'm just using Jerry's name as an example. Jerry Lawler was wrestling in Memphis as a bad guy. Well, then you find another clip where he went up to New York, or well, anywhere, say Charlotte, and he was wrestling as a good guy. So it was sort of an expose on the business, because people are going, man, this guy is wrestling in one place, he's a good guy, another place he's a bad guy. And the other thing was, with those newsletters, they would see ads for Tupelo, Jonesboro, Nashville, Memphis, all the towns of Louisville, and the people, could read through the lines, and they'd say, wow, Jerry Lawler wrestled Dutch Mantell in Louisville. The next night, he wrestled him in Evansville. The night before that, he wrestled him in Memphis. And so in many ways, it was an expose of the business. It wasn't as bad as what, came on later, with the Wrestling Observer newsletter, but it was somewhat of an expose.
Yes, I guess you're right on that. It wasn't direct, as you said, but indirectly, if you had any sense at all, you would able to read between the lines. I was just sitting here, and I was thinking about Buddy Wayne's stories. I wanted to add that. One of the things that once they split, the split with Gulas and Welch and Jerry Jarrett, one of the things besides being the spot show promoter, and a lot of times he promoted Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Mississippi, but also they used, for many, many years, they used Buddy's ring for television. They also used his ring for spot shows, and he had different rings. And I remember a particular story that we were in Senatobia, Mississippi. Handsome Jimmy Valiant was on the card, and Buddy had the ring there. Also, they were running a shot up in Kentucky, and Christine Jarrett was promoting that, and Eddie Marlin was promoting Senatobia, Mississippi. But that was a bad night for rings, because in Senatobia, Mississippi, in the opening match of the night, the ring collapsed and broke, and they couldn't get it back. So they had to bring the high school wrestling mats out there, wrestle the rest of the night, and this was a sellout crowd at a junior college. And then Eddie Marlin was so mad and was about to go really fuss at Buddy and chew out Buddy, but then he got a phone call that same night. Ken Wayne, who was on the way to this Kentucky town, ended up was in a truck wreck with the ring, and the ring was damaged and the truck was damaged, and Ken was a little banged up but not hurt. So then Eddie wasn't going to chew Buddy out on a day like that. But in one night, had two sellout crowds in two different states, completely opposite one another, and neither ring worked that night. Both Buddy Wayne rings.
But he got some heat on that.
Oh, yeah, he did.
A little bit of trivia. Buddy's very first match, or actually not his first match, he wrestled some real small spot shows, because there was a guy that was in the territory at the time named Carol Krauser. He was the guy that was the model for the old Superman TV series. And he got to know Buddy, and Buddy got traveling with him a little bit. Buddy wasn't in the business. He wasn't smartened up. And every time they'd go somewhere, if Carol called him to go, he says, bring your wrestling stuff. He says, you don't know how to wrestle. He says, but you never know when they might need somebody. So there was a time, and I can't remember where it was, that they did call him. And several times after that, they had him wrestle, even though they didn't smarten him up. And that's the interesting thing. They didn't smarten any of these guys up back then. They just, I think Buddy said he actually wrestled for a month or two. Well, I mean, he had to have been, you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind to not realize something was going on. But he would wrestle a month or two, and they would work with him, but they wouldn't, explain anything, or they wouldn't tell him there was going to be a finish or whatever. And he knew something was going to have to happen, but I thought that was so interesting. But anyway, he got in the ring when Carl Krauser was there. Well, then later on, his very first paid match, this is what he told me, was in Jonesboro. I'm trying to remember what I can't remember who he wrestled, but it went on like that for some time. They really didn't smarten him up. He refereed a lot. Referees got back then. If they brought somebody in to referee, or if the referee didn't show up, sometimes they'd pull somebody out of the crowd, and they wouldn't. All they'd tell him was, if a guy's shoulders are down, you count them down. And if his shoulders are, or if he pulls hair and you don't see it, don't make them break. Only make them break if you actually see it. So they did things back then. To me, it was just amazing that they could bring guys in like that, not smarten them up, and still have a match.
Yeah, it was a different time, the golden era.
Yes. Another thing, Buddy wrestled in Georgia real early in his career, and he went into the Army. I don't know if he was drafted or what, but he went into the Army, and apparently he found a letter in one of the general's offices, and it said that they didn't want people. Apparently there had been some other soldiers wrestling professionally, and they didn't want that. And so he went in, and next thing you know, when he went down to Georgia, it must be Don McIntyre at that time, called him, said he would like him to wrestle while he was down there in Georgia. And he says, well, I can, but I can't do that with my real name. And so he wrestled that whole time he was down there for several weeks as a guy, as Jack Burns, Jack Burns, Jack Burns.
Right. I've heard that story myself.
Yeah. And then Nick Gulas is the one that gave him the name Buddy Wayne. Apparently Don Fields, Buddy, Bobby Fields were around a whole lot during those early days when Buddy was wrestling, and people would confuse Buddy's name. He was wrestling at the time as Dwayne Peel, and so people would confuse the two names. So He was together with Nick Gulas one day in the office, and they said, "Let's why don't we start using a different name?" So they decided to use the name Buddy Wayne. Duh. And the funny thing is, though, for a long time, he wrestled in Memphis using the name Dwayne Peel, because the Memphis tapes went into Nashville. They went into Huntsville. So they, whenever he wrestled there, Nashville, Huntsville, he would be introduced as Dwayne Peel. Now, other places like Birmingham had their own TV, Knoxville, any other place he wrestled as Buddy Wayne. And then it started to get to be where people began to realize that he was wrestling under both names. So they started billing him as Buddy Wayne Peel. You've probably seen that, Randy, in the old clippings.
Yeah.
They put all three names, and eventually they just sort of quietly dropped the Peel and just called him Buddy Wayne. So it was sort of a natural progression of things. And the other thing about names with Buddy is he went up to Toledo and he wrestled as Cowboy Wayne. I think it was Don Fargo, I believe, gave him that name, but he thought he ought to try something different, sort of a little bit of a gimmick. He wore a buckskin shirt, cowboy hat, that, you know, and cowboy boots, and that kind of thing. So he had several, you know, three or four different names during his career.
It's very interesting for sure. And then later on, in 1998 to 2001, when I had Power Pro Wrestling and his son, Aubrey, and obviously Aubrey's legal name was Aubrey Peel, but his referee name was Aubrey Wayne.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, great, great referee. Another era, the guys were talking about the deal with the Gilberts, and that was great to launch not only Ken Wayne's career, but it's the program that launched Eddie Gilbert's career, because Buddy was established and Tommy Gilbert was really established. But later on in about 1985, and this was around the time, I think, Tom Ernesto, and you might have had some dealings with Tom when he was booking for Nick, I don't know, but he was booking for Jarrett in 85. Wasn't the greatest reign in the world, but he certainly had tremendous success in Georgia and L.A. and Puerto Rico. So Tom Ernesto was a real good booker. He didn't have a lot of luck on the Memphis end, but he did put Buddy Wayne in the role as a manager, and he managed Ron Sexton, Billy Travis, and Ken Timms, I believe I'm right on that. And they drew some money and had program matches as well, and they were in a featured spot during that era in Memphis in 1985. And when Billy Travis was switched to babyface in 85, you know, he was turned on by his manager, Buddy Wayne. Oh, Buddy was evil.
I do remember that. Like I said, I didn't watch wrestling hardly ever, but I do remember tuning in, just flipping channels and seeing it and seeing Buddy doing the managing bit.
Well, guys, my co-host QT is with us, and I believe he might have a couple of questions. So, QT, if you got anything, go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Sign Guy. Hello, Scott. Hello, Randy.
Hey. Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing very fine. Scott, we recently had on Pacific Northwest wrestler Dutch Savage in our tribute month, and Dutch Savage was born in Pennsylvania, and then he lived for a time in Maryland, and then he got his start in wrestling in Georgia. And he worked the territories in the South briefly before moving out to the Northwest. Do you know if Dutch Savage ever wrestled Buddy Wayne when Dutch Savage was a youngster?
If he did, it would have been in Georgia, but I mean, to the best of my recollection, I have never seen Dutch Savage on a card with Buddy Wayne. I mean, there's been thousands and thousands of cards, you know, but to me, that probably would have stood out, if Buddy was on it, because Buddy didn't go to Georgia. You know, if he did, it was, yeah, I mean, Buddy would go to Georgia, but it would just be like for one shot or two shots or something, just to fill in or something. And I don't remember ever seeing Buddy's name in any of the Georgia results. So I seriously doubt it. And I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong on this. I don't think Dutch came into Tennessee. in the Nashville and that's a good question. I'll have to research that a little bit, but I really don't think so.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll also try to do a little research. Okay. All right.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, okay. Randy, on September 3rd, 1979, for CWA, Steve Regal, Tommy Gilbert, and Tommy Gilbert Jr. defeated Buddy Wayne, Danny Davis, and Ken Wayne. How did Steve Regal get along with Buddy Wayne? Because I heard that Steve Regal grew up in the tough industrial town of Blackpool, England.
You know, I think you're mistaken. First of all, two different Steve Regals.
Yes.
Steve Regals. The Steve Regal you're talking about still works for the WWE. He's been in WCW. He's in NXT. Now, Scott, help me with this, with the Steve Regal. Was it either Bruiser's, Dick the Bruiser's son-in-law, or Wilbur Snyder's son-in-law?
I don't know if Regal was. Now, I could be wrong. I know, what's his name?
Spike Huber.
Spike Huber, that's what I'm trying to think of. Yeah, he was Dick's son-in-law, and Huber was in the main events with WWA in Indianapolis for month after month after month, and then he got divorced from Bruiser's daughter, and all of a sudden he was in the opening match.
Right, and so then it was Steve Regal was kin to Wilbur Snyder then. Both of them had that connection. So to answer your question, we just have mistaken identity there, but Steve Regal was a classic baby face, good-looking guy, could work like a son of a gun, and was on the Memphis end. And to tell you the truth, because back then with no cable TV, I don't have any idea what was on Scott's end. Scott didn't see a lot of what I was seeing, and I didn't see a lot of what Scott was seeing during that point. So I don't know if Steve Regal wrestled much in Nashville.
Oh, okay. All right.
He came in for us maybe on one show. I don't remember him coming in more than that. I just remember him being there one night. And I'll tell you when it was, when it wasn't for Nick, because Nick in 1980, he sold his business to Buddy Fuller, which, you know, when you look behind the scenes, it was, you know, that was a Jerry Jarrett deal. But Buddy Fuller was the promoter at the time, and I guess he had put in some money. But Steve Regal came in for, I was still working for Buddy for, shoot, I guess 6-7 weeks, and then all of a sudden Jerry took over. But while Buddy was there, Dick Steinborn was doing the booking, and he did bring Steve Regal in. And I don't think it was for more than one or two shows, but Regal, that as far as I can remember, he never came in for Nick Gulas when Nick was actually promoting it.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Well, Scott, do you know if the wrestler named Jackie Fargo was ever a member of the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunions? Because Buddy Wayne had some very good matches with Jackie Fargo, and even he had a title match on October 12, 1985, Jackie Fargo. Is he a member of the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunions?
Jackie never went to the Gulf Coast Reunion. We tried to get him there. I tried to get him here to my reunion. Don Fargo, he loved this reunion here at our house, and he regularly went to the Mobile Gulf Coast Wrestlers Reunion as well in Mobile. I mean, he was always there. Jackie never would. Jackie's whole thing was, what are they going to pay me to be there? He could not get past the deal that it was a reunion. It was a fun time for the boys to get together and relive old times and talk about old memories and old stories. He thought every time he went somewhere, he should be paid for it. And I never could understand that thinking, because, you know, all these guys passed away, I went 27 years in a row to the Gulf Coast reunion, never missed it. And a lot of the guys did the same. And we had so much fun telling stories. And I mean, we would laugh. I mean, you'd come back and you'd be hoarse and talking and laughing. But Jackie, all he wanted was the money. He just had no interest in it. And which I don't understand, when you're around the business for, you know, he was in the business, I'd say a good what, Randy, 25 years, I guess, that you wouldn't want to be around, you know, your old compatriots, the people you used to travel with, and just sharing
the good
times.
One of the things Bill Dundee mentions a lot, that Jackie, that you, when Bill first got in the office and with the booking, Jerry Jarrett would tell him, call Fargo, and Fargo, he would call Fargo, and at a point, he was so burned out and did this for so long, and he had other means of income, and you know, what he did in Nashville and the stuff that he got into in the Carolinas and that sort of thing, and he was making money off that. When Dundee would call him to book, and they'd fly him in and offer him a good guarantee, and Fargo would very rarely do it, and he would tell Dundee, he said, Bill, when you get older, and I think Bill has said recently he's like that too, and of course you would think Bill will be 76 in October, you would think it makes sense why he would come to this region. Sometime you just don't want to go. And I think, Scott, that it just that even for money, I just think it was another part of his life that he was famous because of it, made a fortune because of it. Then he did other things, and it was hard to get him back in the business, even though in 95 I brought him in for a legend show in Memphis, and I believe it was end of June 95, Louisville on a Sunday and Memphis on a Monday, or Memphis Saturday and Louisville on a Sunday, as a matter of fact, and we flew him in, and then he wanted to be limoed from the town, and that was good because Jerry Jarrett had a limo, so that was no problem. But anyway, Jerry Jarrett probably drove the limousine. I don't know if he did or not, but anyway, it was real hard to even, Scott, for a promoter or a booker to talk Jackie Fargo into making a shot, even with a good payoff, in a major town. It was just hard. He just went on to other things, and certainly he wasn't going to go for no money.
Yeah, I can understand that. I can see where he's coming from. To him, it was all – that's what Donnie Fargo told me. He said, to Jackie, the wrestling business was never anything to him other than making money. That was all it was. To a lot of the guys, they did it because they loved it. They were absolutely just – I mean, there's still marks when you get right down to it. A lot of the guys still am after all these years. And Jackie always – looked at it as a business. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about the relationships. He didn't care about the, you know, reminiscing on the old times. And to me, that's foreign thinking to me. I just don't understand that, because I have so much fun, and everybody has. We have so much fun at these reunions. Just have you ever been to the Gulf Coast reunion, Randy?
No, I never did. Obviously, I know it doesn't matter, but I was never a part of that in any way. Never. I think Don Bass, remember our old buddy Don Bass, he invited me a few times, but at the pier, you know, on the road, when you're on the, especially running a territory, you know, you don't have time to do those sort of things back then, you know, and then after
right.
that, you know, we lose track. But no, I've never been to a wrestling reunion. Tony Falk always said, I'm going to talk to Scott Till. He said, you're supposed to work for Nick Goulas, but I think we can make exception with you. And Dundee one time said, I'm going to call Scott Till, but I couldn't go that particular time again. I was busy. But Dundee wanted me to come to your reunion. Tony Falk, absolutely, 100%, you could hire him as your PR person, because he puts it over so much.
I love Tony. Tony's one of my favorite people. You don't get much better than Tony.
No, he's
well, we would have loved to have had you here, and I was just asking, because I couldn't remember if you had ever been at the Mobile reunion, and you missed some great times, but maybe, you know, sometime soon you'll be able to make another one. It's just fun sitting around just telling old war stories. And we used to fill up the Red Roof Inn there. I mean, fill up. And it was a ground level, just one level motel rooms. And we would fill both sides. And you'd walk down the breezeway past the rooms, and every single door would be – now, this is back in the late 90s, early 2000s. You walk down the breezeway past the rooms, every door was open, and you'd see 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys in there on the beds and the chairs, sitting up on the desk, telling stories. And it was so funny, because somebody would tell a story, start telling a story. It's like Sputnik Monroe would tell a story, and as soon as he finished, Rip Tyler would jump in. He says, "Oh, that reminds me of the time that blah 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 blah." And when he finished, Joe Turner would say something. I mean, it was a smorgasbord of stories the whole weekend, and that was probably my favorite time ever in all my years in the wrestling business, because it was just the time of, we sat around and you went home, you didn't remember any of the stories anybody had told because it was like overload. You know, it was like your hard drive brain had filled up with so many stories you couldn't remember anything. But it was just great, just great, great times.
Wow. Well, gentlemen, the Cauliflower Alley Club is known for their cribbage challenges and cribbage tournaments. Who is the best cribbage player at the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunions? Cribbage player.
Well, they didn't really have cribbage at the Gulf Coast Reunion. They didn't ever set that up. I mean, there may have been guys. I know Bill White would take his cribbage board and set it up, but Bill White and Dick Beyer both were top of the notch when it came to playing cribbage. And they were both there many years, and so I would say it was one of them. Of course, both of them were champions at one time or another at the CAC as well. So it would be Bill White and Dick Beyer without question.
Well, okay. All right. Well, guys, toward the end of his career, I'm sure Buddy Wayne probably met some of these women of GLOW, maybe Queen Kong, Baby Doll, Misty Blue, Wendy Richter, Tina Ferrari, and maybe Mad Dog Debbie. Do you know if he ever got into the ring with any of these women of GLOW?
I would say no, Scott. But at the same time, of all the names that you mentioned, he did know Wendy, because Wendy worked the Memphis end of the territory several times. So he would have known her before, but as far as we weren't exactly booking intergender matches back then for sure, so getting in the ring with them, you know, I would doubt it very much.
Yeah, I would say no, absolutely not. I'm pretty certain of that as well.
All right,
well, guys,
Scott,
just a few more minutes left. I want to get in any last memories or stories that you might have of the late great Buddy Wayne. So, Mr. Hales, if there's anything you want to say about Buddy, any stories, go right ahead.
Buddy was just around the Memphis part of the territory for a long time. Buddy was a promoter that knew his bread and butter with the wrestling fans. So maybe Buddy sometime is advanced and wrestling changed and wrestling moved on. He didn't really like those changes and didn't like the particular styles. He hated it when they started playing music for everybody. He thought the Fabulous Ones were killing the territory. But where Buddy was smart was that he listened to his fans. And even though he didn't agree with the style of wrestling that was being done, he realized with what was drawing money, and he would go with it 100%. So Buddy was just always the type of guy that had a great feel for what the fans wanted, and I think that's his biggest attribute as far as being a spot show wrestling promoter.
All right, and it looks like we might have one other guest calling in. Let's take them right away. Do we have the caller from the Memphis area?
Yeah, you do.
Who do we have?
Hello. This is Buddy's son, Greg.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, Randy.
No, that was Scott Till. That was Scott Till. Hey, Greg, you were my star last night. I've already plugged you today. Thanks for doing Facebook Live last night.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Randy. Well, just got off work and got home, so I know I caught part of the show. I didn't catch all of it, and pretty much the story that I heard Randy tell about the two rings breaking down, not making the shows, is true. Randy's right; he did get some heat over it.
Well, Greg, obviously you would have known Buddy better than anyone here today. Could you tell us a little bit about what you think the legacy of Buddy Wayne is as far as not only just wrestling, but wrestling especially in the Memphis region where he spent the bulk of his career, and maybe Buddy as a person?
Well, when Daddy would watch the matches, and some of the younger guys would come back and ask him what they, you know, what he thought. Daddy wasn't one to hold back. He would tell them exactly the way he thought, things that they should have done, things they should have changed, things that they shouldn't do. and he was very blunt about it. But again, there has been people that have taken the advice and have traveled the world. Tony Myers, matter of fact, is one of them. He has been back and forth to Japan several times. You know, the thing is with Daddy is, you know, if you didn't want the truth, don't ask the question, because he's going to shoot to you as straight as he can. Now, as far as changing and everything goes, you know, wrestling changed over the years. Jerry Jarrett said it perfectly. You can't do what they did years ago. You know, after, you know, things got smartened up and everybody knew it was a work, then, you know, that really bothered Daddy. And the day that he died, he still held true to kayfabe. I mean, he wouldn't break it for anything in the world as a person.
Greg, we would if Buddy was around now, he'd be mad at me and you both for doing shows like this and doing the Facebook, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would. Matter of fact, I was thinking about that, and that's why I made a little comment back to you about maybe next time I'll look a little better, you know, not shaving, not being, you know, clean cut and everything. Daddy would have chewed me out one side and up one side and down the other. I mean, that's just the way Daddy was. He always dressed, you know, nice when he went to the matches. Always had on a sport coat. He, you know, he stood out different from everybody else. Several of the world champions, you know, they'd come to the matches and they were dressed nice. You know, some of them had on suits, some of them didn't, but they would still look good. They didn't look like the average person out there on the street, and that's what Daddy believed in. You know, I mean, that's just the way it was. There's a couple of guys that I know that currently wrestle, and they show up and they're dressed to the T. I mean, they look nice, they got the hair fixed, you ain't no, you know, beard going on or anything, and they look like something. So, you know, if like Daddy's philosophy was, if you look like something, if you look like everybody else out in the crowd, you're no different. And Daddy believed in being different now, and that's how he always had the attention. And there's been people talk about him for years, and some of them like him, and some of them don't. You know, they just don't care for him. And that's perfectly understandable, because there were times I didn't care for him either when he was getting on my rear end.
But he's right. Why don't you tell, I think the people will be interested in this, Greg. You told it last night. You got real upset, probably cried. You were throwing a fit. Tell them the Sam Bass story because of the fact that you were told not to do something, it saved your life. Tell that story.
Well, it was 1976. It was my 10th birthday. It was July 26th. Wrestling was at the Coliseum that night. I was wanting to go back to Nashville with Sam and spend the week with him and his wife, Dorothy. And Daddy told me no. And I threw a fit, and I cried, and I threw, you know, nine kinds of cane. And later on that night, after I got home and everything, I remember the phone ringing. And that's when Daddy, I don't remember exactly what time, and it was early in the morning. And but Daddy had said, no, I don't, you know, it ain't that I don't necessarily trust Sam. I don't trust his driving because he likes to drink a little bit and he likes to speed. He said, I just don't feel right about it. So Daddy wouldn't let me go. And by him not letting me go, making that decision, having that gut instinct, I'm still here today, because otherwise I'd have been in the car with him and I'd have been burnt up too. So that was something that really impacted me. I thought very highly of Sam and his wife. But I look back years later, you know, and I don't hold it against Daddy. He basically saved my life by not allowing me to do something. So,
hey, Greg, was Sam's wife's name Dorothy? I thought for some reason all these years I thought her name was Jody.
It is Jody.
I'm sorry. It is Jody. My bad. I've got somebody else in my mind. Like I just got home a while ago and I'm tired. So it is Jody. I'm sorry. You are correct.
I would like to add something to that. You talked about, I think you mentioned J.C. Dykes or the Dominoes or something. A lot of people don't realize that the Dominoes, you're talking about the car crash. Well, Frank Hester and Pepe Lopez were the masked Dominoes with J.C. Dykes as their manager. Well, one night in Birmingham, they were scheduled to win the world tag team title. And I don't know if Buddy ever told you this, Greg, but he told me, he says, one of those nights, and I vaguely remember it, but he took the place of one of the Dominoes, and he actually won the world tag team title with either Hester. It must have been Hester as his partner, because he looked more like Pepe Lopez, a white guy. So he was actually world tag team champions in 1977, somewhere around there, unknowingly. I mean, he isn't billed that way, or he isn't recognized as a former world tag team champion, that one anyways, but he did. He won the world tag team title under the hood as one of the masked Dominoes.
Well, again, that leads to the kayfabe end of it. For years, somebody under a hood, nobody knew who it was. Now, the boys did, but didn't nobody tell anybody who it was.
Right.
And it was always a mystery, because when they came into the building, or even before they even got to the building, down the street, they would put their hood on and get out of the car and go in the dressing room. And if anybody was in there that wasn't supposed to be, they left their hood on. And then, when they left, again, same thing. They'd wait till they got down the road a piece, and then they would take their hood off. I mean, that's just the way it was. It was a big mystique of not knowing who it was.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, well, we got just a little bit of time left. Scott Till, did you have any final thoughts on Buddy? Any last stories you wanted to share?
Just that Buddy had more of a part in the business than most people even realize. He played a big, important part in this, and this is for Randy, the Memphis territory. He told me a story one time. He was this must have been around 1998, maybe 2000. He was in Corinth, Mississippi with Aubrey's girlfriend. I think it's Aubrey's wife now. But anyway, he was sitting and joking around with her, and they were sitting there in the arena in Corinth, and he says, you're sitting here with a legend. And she sort of laughed, and it wasn't 10 seconds after some man walks up, and he held out his hand. He says, Buddy, let me shake your hand. Man, you're a legend. And Buddy looked over at Aubrey's girlfriend, and he said, see? I thought that was a funny story. The timing couldn't have been better for that man to walk up and say that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I have been privileged to know Buddy Wayne, and he died way too soon. I was, shocked when I heard the news. I knew it wasn't going to be long, though, because he was really struggling at the end. But I love Buddy, and I just blessed for the time I got to spend with him and to have the opportunity to know him.
Yeah, you're talking about the legend part. The funny part is he would always say the living legend.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
All right, and Greg, if you have any last stories or thoughts you want to share with us, please go right ahead.
Yeah, I've got one that I started to tell last night when I was on with Randy, and I didn't. When I was a little bitty boy, Daddy had a real hard suitcase. I don't remember the type, but anyway, it was a pretty good-sized suitcase. And I want to say we was in Montgomery at the fairgrounds. I don't remember exactly. But anyway, that's when Andre the Giant first came over. Hadn't been in the States very long and could not really speak English. And anyway, the dressing room had a bench up against the wall, but the ceiling sort of slanted where the seats were above him. So anyway, Daddy went in the dressing room, and I stayed out in the hallway. And anyway, a couple of minutes later, he come back out, and he said, "Hey, I got a rib I'm going to play." I was like, "Okay." And I was like 4 or 5 years old. I wasn't very old, and I wasn't very big. So he took everything out of his suitcase and told me to get in and lay down. He said, "I'm going to take you in here and set you down, and I'm going to be talking. And then, you know, whenever I say whatever it was, the cue was, he said, you start making noise and banging on the suitcase." I was like, "All right." He said, "Now I'll open it and let you out." I was like, "Okay." Well, Andre was sitting there, and Daddy was sitting there telling a story to somebody. And about that time, that was my cue, and I banged on the thing and said, hey, let me out of here." And Daddy acted real shocked, like, "Oh, my God, I forgot he was in there." And he laid the suitcase down and opened it up, and I popped out. When I popped out, Andre hit the floor. And it was one of the better ribs that Daddy probably ever pulled. But that was the end of the story on that one. So,
you're right.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. We appreciate it very, very much. And fans, if you've not been familiar with Buddy Wayne, definitely look him up on YouTube and Google search his name and learn more about him. He was a very, very important part of the territorial days of wrestling, instrumental in a lot of people's early careers that went on to be the very top names in this industry. So Buddy Wayne, someone that should be familiar with.
Oh. One thing on what you're saying about Googling Buddy Wayne, make sure it is the Memphis Buddy Wayne and not the other Buddy Wayne that worked for WWF.
Exactly.
There's two Buddy Waynes out there when you Google
Wayne
it.
Wayne and Memphis Buddy Wayne, so keep that in mind when you're Googling. All right, and fans, I want to remind you there's also a show tomorrow night. One of our former guests, Vladimir Koloff, is going to be at the Alabama Wrestling Alliance in Fayot La Batre, Alabama tomorrow. So go check him out if you're in that region. We will be back with you Sunday afternoon, and we will have Cowboy Scott Casey joining us on Sunday. So definitely be here for that. And go out there and support your local independents. We'll talk to you guys soon.